Good stuff right out of the box here in hour number two.
I told you about strawberry fields. You know the place where nothing is real. Well, here's another place you can go.
Our next guest on Downtown is an actor, an author, and a guy we love to talk to on the program because he's also a fan and appreciator of many of the things we love, from Sherlock Holmes to Harry Nilsson to the Beatles. We're thrilled to be joined again by Curtis Armstrong. Good afternoon, Curtis.
Hey, how are you doing?
Doing great. So good to have you back on with us.
Likewise. Very nice. I mean, I've been really looking forward to this since you first mentioned it.
Now, you were up in Canada. Before we talk about the Beatles, you have had a project going on up there. Can you talk about it?
No, that was pretty much strictly a holiday.
Oh, even better.
I was doing a couple of shows last year when you first contacted me about this in the fall. But by the time you reached me up in Canada, I was in my cabin there, just sort of isolated. And it was lovely.
That sounds pretty good as well. Well, this Beatles Remastered White Album 50th Anniversary Edition, very interesting. What are your sort of overall thoughts on the package?
I'll tell you, I don't know even where to begin. I mean, I got this for my birthday, the deluxe box with six discs, as well as the vinyl remix and Escher demos. So I've been going through it. The reason it's taken me so long is, first off, because I had been working and it was I was busy, but also this is just an astonishing collection. It takes so long. It's such a deep dive. It's even compared to Pepper, which, you know, I spent 2 weeks listening to when I first got it. This is obviously twice as long. It's two albums, 30 songs. But on top of that are all of the other things that were being worked on at the time in the sessions. And the book, which relates the whole thing and has pictures and all of that, is just astonishingly deep in its information. So you hear things about it before you actually hear it. Not obviously most people are going to say, well, I don't need, you know, six discs of the White Album. That comes up every time any kind of, you know, 25th anniversary reissue comes out. You go, well, do I really need all of those? This is actually a case where there's a reason why they're all there. Mm-hmm. When you go through the session discs on this album, you don't find stuff that you go, well, yeah, okay, this stuff I can go through. You know, I can do without this. It's all essential. And the fact that there is that much material that came out of those sessions gives you some idea of the fact that they were working at the peak of their creative ability at this point, I think.
John Lennon is rumored to have said that this album is the sound of the Beatles breaking up. And sure, there are elements of that and of the individuals bringing in their own songs. But I also think you hear on this that celebration of what it was like when they did work together.
Well, I think this is another reason to make an interesting comparison to Pepper. Because, you know, first off, with Lennon, you know, the interview he did with Jan Wenner for Rolling Stone became the basis of what everybody thinks they know about the Beatles from 1968 on. And the truth is, he was not a particularly reliable narrator in a lot of respects. And his craziness and bitterness at the point by 1971, when he was looking back on those periods, he was talking, you know, like a crazy person sometimes when you actually line up what was really happening. But I think that when you look at Pepper, you realize it's approximately the same amount of time. We're talking about maybe 6 months in the recording studios. And yet with Pepper, they were together a relatively short period of time. They would put down the basic tracks and then everybody would leave. And it would become, you know, overdubs and orchestrations and all of these kinds of things. And then they would pop back in to do more overdubs and, you know, more vocals and all that. But it wasn't creating work in the recording studio. It wasn't inventing songs, basically, in the recording studio. They were still working on the old idea in Pepper of, you know, you'd come in at 10 and you'd leave at, you know, 7, something along those lines. This was where they suddenly had the keys to the kingdom. They could stay and start and end whenever they wanted to.
Right.
They could go as long as they wanted to. If they wanted to go all night, they could go all night. Well, you know, guess what? On top of all of the other conflicts, you put those four people in a room for, you know, 12 hours at a run, people are going to get on people's nerves. So as a result of, you know, Lennon talking about that and us sort of looking back on it as gospel, we've had a strange idea of what the White Album was. It wasn't that they didn't disagree. Obviously, Ringo left for 11 days. That's been a story that, you know, we've all known about. But I think that under the circumstances, it's kind of amazing that they were able to get through it at all.
It's also the product of a very fertile songwriting period in their career, especially for John Lennon, who I think came to these sessions, with more songs than he had brought in, and probably since back in, what, 64 or so?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think this was all a result of Rishikesh being at Maharishi's place in India, and the fact that they had all four of them for varying periods of time gone there. They discovered meditation, and they were working their way through, you know, what it was like in the world without Brian Epstein, who had died in 67, I guess. This was that period of being isolated, about not having to be places, not having to tour, not having to record, being in this beautiful place, allowed them the freedom to just create. And that was one of the best things that ever happened, because not only do they have the songs that made up the White Album as we know it, this was also where Hey Jude came from. It was where Let It Be came from. It was where Sour Milk Sea and Not Guilty and Circles and all of these tracks that either appeared on their next album or on their solo albums going off into, you know, Jealous Guy, you know, all of those things came from these sessions. Which means that the White Album is basically the core of the rest of the Beatles' career as a group.
We're talking Beatles with Curtis Armstrong here on Downtown. The love Beatles fans have for George Martin, we have passed along to his son, because, again, Giles Martin, I think, has done an outstanding job of making these songs. Not that they didn't sound fresh, but bringing up the vocals in certain ways and just creating a mix that makes them sound so new and vibrant.
Well, yeah, I don't think anybody has. It is in his DNA. I mean, I think he's a remarkable producer, and he has the ear for it. And, you know, it's hard to imagine that they would have gone with anyone else. And the remix is excellent. Some of the songs, I don't know if I prefer the mix over the old one. Some of them are vastly superior. It obviously sounds much better. But for some reason, the remix that they did of Pepper seemed to me to be, that was one where I sat there wide-eyed.
Mm.
In this case, there were some songs that I thought benefited from it and others that didn't particularly.
Well, one of the things that blew me away about the collection were those demos recorded at George Harrison's in May of 68. And let's listen to just a little bit of this demo version of a Beatles classic.
One, two, three, four.
I love these demos so much.
Yeah.
Somebody pointed out it's like if the Beatles had stayed around long enough to do an unplugged session.
Yeah, it's actually the thing about those Escher demos is that they are just bursting with energy. You can hear it. I mean, the way Harrison does that song, it's almost like he can't wait to get it out.
Mm.
You know. And I think that was the thing that they all said from that period, was they had all of these, and certainly Harrison, I think, said that. What do you do when you have all these songs that need to get out? Which is, you know, the whole question of should it have been a single album or a double album? You know, they came back from India full of music and just went into George's place where they felt comfortable, and then vomited it all out on tape.
And there are so many treats in that, too.
That's the thing. And some of those demos have been bootlegged forever, but hearing them in this version is a real delight.
I love the story that we get from John Lennon about Prudence Farrow at the end of that. And then, of course, we hear what became Jealous Guy, but Child of Nature, which is so wonderful.
Yeah, I know. One of those things where, of course, John had been tremendously influenced, maybe as much as any of them, by Maharishi and by meditation, and then, and then went off him. And so he had written Child of Nature sort of under the influence of Maharishi, and then dumped it, but realized he had such a great melody that he would keep it until he could use it, which was for Jealous Guy in 71.
So what are the cuts that really stand out for you on this collection?
Again, I really don't know where to start. I love listening to the development of things. When you get into season five, for example, when you get into things like, I had What's the New Mary Jane in my head, which is a terrible thing to have in your head, I love the version of Good Night.
Oh yes,
this is one of those things where people had said, really, three versions of Good Night? Do we really need three versions of Good Night? But there's a version of Good Night with Ringo singing, and I love Ringo's voice. I know that's a debatable point for people, but I love his voice. And it's the one that has the three other Beatles singing harmonies in the background. It's totally wrong. The version of the album, the version that came out, was the version that should have come out. But I love the fact that they attempted three-part harmony vocals on Good Night. I think it's just marvelous. I also think it's interesting listening to Back in the USSR, how, you know, we've always heard that Mike Love of the Beach Boys, who was at Rishikesh, had given McCartney the idea of making it sound like a Beach Boy number. But the thing that I find really interesting is that in the first couple of versions of that, including the demos, there is nothing like that.
Mm, that's right.
And I'm wondering whether that was something that Mike Love sort of made up and McCartney has sort of gone along with, because there was no evidence of any Beach Boys sort of influence in that song until it really reached the very end.
Wait, you're suggesting Mike Love taking credit for something? That seems so out
Isn't
of character.
Isn't that amazing? I know it's so unlike him, and yet I just have that feeling.
We're talking with Curtis Armstrong here on Downtown. Have you heard anything about plans to maybe do a remastered edition of Abbey Road?
Well, I'm sure they're going to, but you know, they have Revolver to do yet. I mean, there are still places that they can go. I'm sure that they'll wind up doing Abbey Road eventually, because that's, you know, I mean, that's basically the next creative step. There was Let It Be between them, but you know, that's a more complicated situation, because they can't release Let It Be in any form until they finally get around to remastering and issuing the movie. And they seem to be as far away from doing that as ever. But I can imagine maybe Abbey Road would be the next one.
What's your favorite Beatles album?
Oh, that's impossible. I can't even imagine what that would be. I mean, it varies. It changes all the time. I mean, right now I've just got the White Album in my head so much that now I can't think of anything but White Album.
Now, you got the deluxe package, so that also comes with vinyl, right?
Well, I did get the vinyl as well as the CD. Yeah. Yeah, because I like listening to vinyl. But you know, in order to get all of this session material, you have to have the discs.
Well, it's a wonderful.
And here's the thing: I really believe that this is something. Obviously, it's a huge investment, not only of money but of time, to go through this and to go through the book and follow all of the recording notes and all of this stuff. But if you're into that, it is worth every penny to buy this set, because it really is an education in an enormously fertile period in their lives.
And it makes the songs new again, and it not only takes you back to where you were when you first heard them, but you re-experience that feeling anew as the song sounds so fresh. And I think back on something I read a while ago about, if you look at all the artists of the 60s and even the 70s, the Beatles have mined their studio work really less than a lot of other artists, certainly nowhere near as much as Bob Dylan or others. So who knows how much more there is in the archives that we'll get to hear, hopefully.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much that is. But, you know, what they have done, I've always felt, and I'm biased because I like them, but I've always been struck by the classy way in which they've repackaged this material. There are a lot of labels that would be doing this. Fortunately, they have control, and you can't do anything without all four of them signing off. But they've been really good about not flooding the market. When they put out something, it's big, and it makes a lot of noise because they're the Beatles, and these are amazing records. But they don't flood the market with, you know, stuff the way they could.
You've shared the story with us, and of course it's in your book as well, your wonderful memoir, Revenge of the Nerd. But could you tell the story again about 1964, the Beatles on the Sullivan Show, and your initial reaction?
Well, it's a little difficult to explain it, but yeah, I was 64. It was 64, and I was pretty much like anyone, except I was forced to watch them on the Sullivan Show because I wasn't interested in them. I'd heard a lot about them, but I didn't care about them. I wanted to watch The Wonderful World of Disney or whatever it was that I usually watched at 8 o'clock on a Sunday. I had no interest in the Beatles. And my sister, who was 2 years younger, she was the one who forced it, and I watched it grudgingly. And by the end of it, I was frankly flushed and aroused. I mean, it's the only way that I can describe it. It was a massive moment in my life. And it was the beginning of everything.
Curtis, when's the next time we get to see you either on screen or on our television? What's coming up for projects for you?
Well, right now on YouTube Red is a series I shot with Adam Pally and Sam Richardson last year, and my old partner Elise Beasley from Moonlighting. We did a series called Champaign, Illinois, which is showing on YouTube Red right now. And then next month, or I guess March, I will be seen on a recurring character on Sci-Fi's show Happy with Chris Maloney and Patton Oswalt. So those two, and then one other one which we've just started but is still sort of on the hush.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to that. We love Happy, so that's fantastic. We'll look forward to that. And, man, it's always great to talk with you, especially not just about your career, but especially the things you love, like the Beatles. So, Curtis, thanks again for making time for us.
My pleasure. It was great talking to you again. And maybe we'll talk the next time when they finally put out the deluxe Abbey Road session.
That sounds great. Thanks again, Curtis.
All right. Bye.
That's Curtis Armstrong with us here on Downtown. And if you haven't read it, check out his wonderful book, Revenge of the Nerd, a great story of his career in movies and television. Very, very interesting and smart guy, Curtis Armstrong.